Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow it just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. This is your regular Wednesday host, Kim Justice, and if you want to know more about me, you can find it at my website, inaflash.org. I've been a host here every Wednesday night for, 10.5 years, I think. And the last Wednesday of each month, I've had my Simon Says segment, where Simon Lewis normally joins me as my co-host. Unfortunately, he's been going through some trying, painful surgery and recovery and resting, and so he's not going to be here tonight, but I wish him speedy recovery. Our prayers, our thoughts and prayers go out to you, Simon, if you're listening, and hoping you're going to be feeling better soon. Looking forward to having you back in time to talk about what we're thankful for at the end of November. But tonight, we are kind of pre-Halloween. Not sure, because they've got all the Christmas stuff out. If you guys noticed that we haven't even done Halloween and Thanksgiving yet. Halloween is Sunday. And I'm going to talk about that in a couple of moments. And I'm going to read a couple of things, but I want to invite you guys tonight. What I said, for those of you who didn't catch the show notes, life circumstances we didn't sign up for that change our life, spooky, brings on the internal goblin, feels like a trick, certainly no treat, the ghostly aspects of brain injury, the often invisible injury that leaves us wondering if people can really see us anymore. Feel free to call in tonight and discuss the other side of your brain injury, what scares you, or if you've had a near-death experience. I would talk about that tonight. Or anything else that has to do weighing on your mind about brain injury and or Halloween. No tricks, by the way, or there will be no treats. So this is not troll night. But I do welcome you to call 424-243-9540 and share. Again, 424-243-9540. Now, I'm going to start with telling you generally, newcomers, what my show is about. Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. we focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. So, normally I have on a guest, and I do interviews on a variety of topics, from directly brain injury related topics to topics, you know, we're all recovering from something at various points in our life. We all transcend different passages at different points in our life. And so some of the people I interview are general interest, entertainment, or inspirational, spiritual. When I talk about the fact that this is a we recovery program, because the me, all by myself, I found out for me, I didn't have broad enough shoulders to do this. My brain injury happened in 1995. Believe it or not, that was before computer, social media. There were no support groups. All these years later, there still aren't where I live. There wasn't any way to get help or support, because if you were like me and you wound up normal after the better part of a year in my case, after my injury, my expectation and the expectation of people around me is that I was broken, I was fixed, and now I'm well. And that couldn't have been further from the truth. People couldn't really see me anymore for what I was. They saw the person I was before, but inside, I had changed. My experience changed me. So I'll talk about the other side of brain injury, and I'll talk about my near-death experience, and I'll talk about what scares me. Those were three of the criteria. You can pick one or any of the three. And if you'd like to talk, and you're on the switchboard, because there's a lot of people on the switchboard listening tonight, then I encourage you to press 1, and I'll know that you want to talk. So press 1 if you'd like to talk, and I will bring you on the air. And other than that, I'll just assume you're listening unless I see you put your hand up, is what we call it, by pressing 1. First, I'm going to start off with a little show and tell on Halloween. It's changed a lot. Halloween's origins date back to the ancient Celtic festival of Samhain. The Celts, who lived 2,000 years ago, mostly in the area that is now Ireland, the United Kingdom, and northern France, celebrated their New Year on November 1st. This day marked the end of the summer and the harvest and the beginning of the dark, cold winter, a time of year that was often associated with human death. Celts believed that on the night before the New Year, the boundary between the worlds of the living and the dead became blurred. On the night of October 31st, they celebrated Samhain, when it was believed that the ghosts of the dead returned to Earth. In addition to causing trouble and damaging crops, Celts thought that the presence of the otherworldly spirits made it easier for the druids, or Celtic priests, to make predictions about the future. For a people entirely dependent on the volatile natural world, these prophecies were an important source of comfort during the long, cold winter. To commemorate the event, Druids built huge sacred bonfires where the people gathered to burn crops and animals as sacrifices to Celtic deities. During the celebration, the Celts wore costumes, typically consisting of animal heads and skins, and attempted to tell each other's fortunes. When the celebration was over, they relit their hearth fires, which had extinguished earlier that evening, from the sacred bonfire during the coming winter. And as a fun fact, did you know a quarter of all the candy sold annually in the United States is purchased for Halloween? So hopefully that supply chain problem we're having allowed the candy to make it to the store for those that still trick-or-treat. It seems as society changed, and by the way, that was the history, ancient history of Halloween, Christianity kind of came in there and took over. And then when the Celts moved to the States and Christianity took over, and the first was All Saints Day, where people dined and recognized their religious martyrs, the complexion of Halloween changed from the pagan celebration it was to dressing up and going out and asking for money and candy. And so thus our new Halloween. And caller, I'll be right with you. So in any case, these days, when I was young, we did go out and ring doorbells and trick-or-treat. And we didn't even have to have an adult with us. And then times changed, and it did, in fact, get scarier out there. So the adults started coming, and then Halloween kind of trended more to going to the mall or going to parties and not going door to door anymore. So it's evolved and changed over the years, but we still recognize it. I thought of Halloween the other day, and it wasn't because of the pumpkins. There's a city my husband and I, many of you know, like to take country drives, and we were a month late because of this broken foot of mine, but we drove down to a city about an hour away that is filled with orchards. This is the home of Arbor Day, so if you like to plant trees and you're into that kind of ecology, this is the place it started. And J. Sterling Morton, who made the salt, the little girl with the umbrella, that salt, started Arbor Day. And Arbor Lodge is down in this city where we went, and quite a few orchards. And as we were driving this hour, you know, those of you who know me on Facebook have seen the fields of green corn, and I keep sticking my husband in front of the corn and taking a picture from the time it was knee-high to the time it was towering over him to the time it was all dead-looking. And the end of the harvest was going on last weekend as we drove that way. And luckily for the people who are able to acquire their big John Deere equipment before the strike, they were out there on the road and in the fields all over. And the dust from the crops being harvested were... now I know why we usually go a month earlier. The apples were looking a little sad hanging on the trees, and there were probably more on the ground than on the trees when we went. But this year, it's, I don't know about where you live, but our leaves changing color has been really freaky this year. That normally happens a month ago, too. But our green leaves have been changing from green to dead. Hasn't been a lot of color. And last weekend, some color finally started showing up. But we're starting to get real close to freezes at night and a lot of heavy rain and winds. And I'm thinking that those leaves are going to be blowing off, so we're not going to have the explosion of the splendor of that color this year. I hope you will in your area, but I did take some photos from the car. This Frankenstein boot I have to wear doesn't allow me to go out and walk through the fields and things like I normally do to take pictures, but I did what I could. So, with that in mind, I have a caller, and I'm going to bring them on. And again, tonight, if you'd like to talk about a near-death experience you've had or the other side of your brain injury, how things have changed, or what scares you, then I welcome you to call 424-243-9540. One, if you'd like to speak. I would love to hear from you. Area code 513, you're on the air. How you doing? Who's this?
Doing all right. I'm JJ. It's nice to meet you, more so than I
Hi.
Have before. And
I'm
so, go ahead.
Nothing. I'm just so happy you called. It's very nice to meet you, JJ. We met prematurely, listeners, through, I put some posts out looking for people who might be interested in participating in the show tonight, and I got some responses back from people I do know, but there were two people I did not know, and JJ was one of them. So I appreciate you calling in tonight, and it's really nice to meet you.
It's nice to more so officially meet you now. So you wanted to talk about near-death experiences and a couple of other things. That was the first thing I wanted to hit on, if that's cool with you.
Please, shoot.
So being a member of the aneurysm survivor group that we are in on Facebook, that was a near-death experience for me. I know many people will have an aneurysm throughout their life and not even know until they get a CAT scan or MRI that might reveal something, and then they'll get a surgery to remove that, typically without much complication. Unfortunately, I had no idea I had an aneurysm. At 17 years old, it ruptured. I was lying down in my bed at the time doing some work on memorization for a competition that I had coming up, and I had headaches the week leading up, was worried it was just migraines, and I was growing into that, so I wasn't too happy about it. But I eventually get to the point where the pain is really hard to handle. It literally felt like being shot in the head at that point. The doctors say I had what they call a thunderclap headache, which is actually only compared to the pain of literally being shot in the head. So I walked up to my sister, and I was in this moment of sheer dread and terror because of the pain that I was feeling. And I look at her, I say her name, I say, I feel like I literally just got shot in the head. At that point, I get down and I go to the restroom at my house, and I kneel over the toilet because I felt like I was going to throw up, the pain being so difficult. And you know that feeling you get when it is terrifying and there's like a pit in your stomach and you can't figure out, you don't know exactly what to do, really. It was kind of that, but I felt like I was going to throw up. So I waited. I tried to get myself ready. I eventually passed out, and I wound up eventually getting rushed to the hospital for the ruptured aneurysm. But they actually thought I was on drugs because of what was happening. They couldn't figure out. The EMTs, they administered something that they would usually give to somebody who overdosed. So it was pretty crazy.
Do you think that was because of your age and their ignorance, or
So I don't even directly think it was ignorance. I think it was a smart move on their part, because most of the time, I was 17 at the time. Now, I stayed away from drugs because I didn't know how good my brain was in the first place. I didn't want to mess it up anymore. But I think it was smart on their part for actually giving me something, because most of the time the kids are on drugs anyway, and I could have just had something that was laced in something or overdosed. So I'm thankful that they did seek to do what they knew was best. And though, yeah, I didn't necessarily need it, I don't think it really hurt me in the long run. At least I have not been able to distinguish anything from it that would specifically be that, that could be a long-term effect, if that makes sense.
It does. But in the meantime, you're having an a rupture. So
yeah.
Going back to that, when they figured out that you weren't a druggie and they took care of the chance that that could be the answer, and obviously it wasn't the answer, I'm going to assume that whatever they gave you for presumed drugs did not help your pain in the head.
Oh, no. Well, I had passed, I was out of it at that point completely, because my brain, I was seizing, and it was like I could not comprehend anything. I could not figure out what was going on. I passed out, so it didn't really make much of a difference for my cognitive awareness at the time. They wound up rushing me to the nearest hospital, because as an EMT, and if you're taking somebody in critical condition and you don't know what exactly is going on, you stop at the nearest hospital. That's just what you do.
Right.
From that point, because they do not specialize at the hospital to which they took me, they actually air cared me or flew me to the children's hospital in the area, because at 17, I still qualified as a child. So they had brain surgeons and specialists there. They were very qualified and did a very good job. The crazy thing for me, though, at first they put glue in my head. I didn't know that you could do that for an aneurysm, but they put glue in my head to stop the bleeding. So from there...
What year was this?
That's fine. This was 2017.
Okay. The only reason I ask is
actually,
I was aware of that. Sorry?
It was 2018. I'm sorry. Because it happened in January of 2018. That's my bad. I just wanted to make sure I got the year right. But go ahead.
Oh, no, you're cool. Wow, mine happened in a January, too. Much longer ago than yours. But And I'll tell you about that after you're done with your story. But I was just curious about the glue, because I knew of that. I kind of watched, like, this is the only part I'll tell you about mine. When I had mine back in 95, the only option was dying or having a full-on craniotomy and being clipped, which is what I was. And then afterward... the coil came along not too much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard about the glue and a couple other things, and I haven't heard about them since. And then, you know, now I'm hearing about bypasses, kind of like they do with the heart, but with the brain.
Yeah.
And a couple things like that. But it's been a really long time. I mean, like a decade or more since I've heard of the glue, so I was just interested in the fact that they were still using that. So, okay, great.
Yeah.
Go on.
Well, when I found out that they put glue in my head, I was a tad bit confused at first, because a year prior to my aneurysm rupture, I actually found an app that was called Surgeon Simulator. I got on it, and it was about a year exact, not quite to the date, but it was close to the time period. I had done a aneurysm like plugging of some sort or extraction of my own inside the op because it's a simulator, and they actually walked me through the steps to do it, to cut open the skull a bit in there. And so it was interesting that it almost seemed like a precursor, which is kind of freaky, but simulation surgery almost a year in advance. But yeah, they use glue. They don't seek to use that as a permanent fix, though. So what happened was I had the glue put in at first because they were just trying to get the blood to stop going around my brain, and they wanted to do it as quick as they could. They went in as you would through an angiogram, through an artery in the leg. They went up and they inserted glue inside the vessel in my brain so that it couldn't keep bleeding. I also went through a good bit of recovery because they wanted to make sure I got to a good point. And then they did another surgery and completely removed the aneurysm. I believe they did a bypass at that point. So they actually removed the blood vessel, the tangled mass of blood vessels. And I believe that they cauterized the wound so that it couldn't bleed anymore. But yeah, it was crazy because I had to relearn how to walk. And then when they did the second surgery, I had to regain some muscle mass again because it kind of took a little bit from me.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely does. That's interesting that they did it in so many steps. When you talked about the hospital, just for the sake of the audience, I want to interject just a thing here and there, and the Children's Hospital JJ went to undoubtedly was a level one trauma center. He's right. Normally, when you call 911 and an ambulance comes, if they don't know what's going on, then they take you to the nearest hospital. That's the protocol. But not every hospital is a level one trauma hospital. And that's where you're going to find neurosurgeons and the kind of practitioners who can deal with the heavy-duty stuff like this, like the brain. So, not that you would be aware of that. I was no more aware than JJ was when I was in that position, so I can't picture many of us tapping the EMT on the shoulder saying, are you going to the level one trauma hospital? I can tell you the way I'm feeling. That's what it's going to take. But in any case, it might be good to know if you have a history in your family or if you've had an aneurysm before and maybe you've moved, to find out where the level one trauma hospitals are in your area or closest to you. And if you're looking for a new doctor or surgeon, you might want to search within that network so that you're always prepared. But anyway, that's interesting that they took so many steps. I wonder why they didn't just do the bypass in the first place. Now, I'm not a doctor. I'm just another survivor. I'm qualifying that for the audience, too, not
yeah.
you. But that angiogram
type procedure.
I can
tell you what I do now,
procedure.
If you would like.
Good. Tell me, because that's how they put the coil in. To my understanding, maybe you didn't have the kind that could be coiled. I know that treatment also has a lot to do with how big it is, where it is,
mm-hmm.
whether it's bleeding or not, that kind of thing. But go ahead, tell me.
With my aneurysm, I found out it was near the area where vision is controlled, partially because after the rupture, I had a field cut. I lost pretty much half of my vision field on the left side. Cool enough as it is, my brain was able to repair itself, and I still have a little bit of a field cut, but it's not even noticeable. If you are around me, you're not going to know. But that was the primary place where the rupture happened in my brain, where it processes vision. And they did take a number of steps, but my family was unaware of any history regarding anybody having an aneurysm until my dad asked his mother after the rupture that I had, and found out that one of his like great uncles died from an aneurysm rupture because he wasn't able to make it to a hospital in time. And that was after my rupture that we found out. So it was confusing to us because we had no idea that this was going to happen. But that I'm still alive today, I'm told, is a miracle, and I think it's pretty interesting. But it was definitely – I was a little bit confused on how they handled everything at first, but looking at the way that it was, since they put the glue in so I could heal a little bit until they could actually extract it safely and really make sure that I was doing well, they handled it in an amazing way. I think so, at least.
Of course. I think so, too. And I'm so glad that your vision rectified quite a bit for you. Is that, do you have other residuals that you deal with? Short-term memory problems. I'll rattle off a couple.
Yeah, just after my aneurysm, I had terrible short-term memory. I actually started referencing it as Dory syndrome because I had to find a way to cope with all this. Like what are you going to do? So I called it Dory syndrome. My girlfriend's father at the time, sometimes he would greet me, he'd say, "Hi, Dory." And every once in a while, I'd joke and I'd say, "You know, I'm going to forget you said that anyway." Because my short-term memory was pretty much shot. Thankfully, it got better. I actually did a lot of research to figure out how the brain works after everything happened. I found out there's a portion of the brain called the hippocampus. It's actually responsible for the production of new neurons, and it can allow your brain to heal a lot. And it also helps a lot with your memory. I didn't realize quite how significant it was with that. But I found out it's inhibited anytime you're depressed, you're stressed, you've got anxiety, like anything that's negative in your brain, it's basically going to shut down if you are overcome with one of those negative thoughts. So I started to seek to take care of my mental health a lot more. And I tried going to a counselor for a while, but I unfortunately wasn't able to find anyone that was able to quite connect with me as I would have needed for the counselor. So I had to look up a lot of different helps and figure out what it was I truly needed and then not treat myself as a professional, but see what I could do to help myself rectify anything I was dealing with in that regard.
Yes. Unfortunately, a lot of us are left to that. One of the biggest complaints I have and hear is I'm grateful for those practitioners who save our life, but then they check on you a couple times and let you go, you know, cut you loose when surgery is deemed to be a success, and then there's not really anyone around to coordinate the care that one might need for that bushel basket of after effects that often come with it, things like some people have PTSD come with it, or anxiety and depression, sensory overload, too many things, you know, sensitivity to noise, bright lights. You might have been somebody who could juggle a million balls at one time, and now you really have to just focus on what's in front of you and goes slower. You know, when I'm in a hurry, I'll be maybe typing something on an email and you'll catch me transposing letters or having the word in my mind I mean to say. I mean, I know what I want to say, but I type a different word. So some cognitive impairment often comes with, and sleep issues are also something that's common with people that have brain injury, along with that short-term memory. So, you know, there's such a smattering of different problems, and my experience anyway is that, you know, they, depending on what doctors you go to, and you didn't allude to this exactly, but I tried going to some of those therapists in the beginning, and they wanted to throw pills at it, and that wasn't helpful because I still had all those symptoms I just mentioned.
Yeah.
But the pill didn't help those things, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm not sure what they what they did. So nothing really, you know, got you the ticket into the door to be able to talk to the therapist, I guess. But you know, not really understanding it, I found, for me anyway, after going to many therapists and going out like you did, and I'm interested in hearing different things that helped you, but, you know, I went and tried yoga and meditation and Tai Chi and DBT, skills training. I did a skills training course thing for about 3.5 years. And so those were all things I heard about from other people, and it was really one of the impetus of me becoming a host a long time ago, is because I didn't want anyone to have to go through it the way a lot of us do, which is hit and miss on our own. I hoped to bring some of these solutions to the airwaves where people from all 50 states and 49 countries are listening, and then this live show goes into the archive. So, you know, when people are sharing these kind of things, you know, things like hyperbaric oxygen treatment, you know, there's a lot of different methodologies out there that people try, and there doesn't seem to be any magic bullet, but we each find our combination that helps us, I would say, reach stability. I don't know. I'll be anxious to hear the person that says what they find erased it and made them completely well. But for a lot of us, it's the tools we need to manage our life better on a daily basis and not let those residuals eat us up. You know, we're trying to take our life back, you know, and do a workaround, or not really a workaround, a work through the cards that we've been dealt, and be able to develop a quality of life, you know, worth living, instead of being stuck with those symptoms and getting eaten alive by the negativity you were talking about, and depression and things like that, that often come with the frustration of going to doctor after doctor after doctor after doctor, knowing you need help, but not, you can talk about your symptoms, but they don't know. I haven't met one that knows an answer beyond throwing a pill at it, which isn't a solution for me, which leaves us at an impasse. And so, this is very good that we talk about these things, so others out there are able to get ideas of things that they might try.
I found it interesting as I was healing, because having gone to a children's hospital, they had me in speech therapy, occupational therapy, and physical therapy. I actually attended that for about 6 months, at which point they said I didn't need physical therapy anymore because I was normal regarding my physical ability. However, that was a little less than I usually did, because I thought to be a bit more physical fit. Thankfully, I've gained back some of the physical fitness that I had. But with occupational therapy and speech therapy, because speech focuses mostly on cognitive ability, more so than just speech in general, and then occupational focuses on your ability to do things that you need to do throughout the day. What I realized was that, because I had been going for, like I said, about 6 months, I think I may have even gone, let's see, I did the 6 month follow-up. I may have been going for almost a year afterward. I don't know that I reached quite a year, But I got to the point where I realized I wasn't really seeing any progression. I sought to follow my therapist's instruction as they sought to guide me in my progression. However, the being children's therapists, as it being a children's hospital, they can only do what they really were certified to do, what they knew how to do. So I don't directly blame them, but I got to the point where I decided I don't really want to go anymore. Because it wasn't helping me.
Yeah.
It was like they were trying to turn me into a child almost. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but they were just trying to give me the ability that a child would have at the time. But being 17, I was about to become an adult, technically. So I then, once I stopped going to therapy, I technically hadn't graduated high school. So I started researching everything I could. That's how I figured out the information that I relayed earlier about the hippocampus. I started seeing the way that my brain works. I knew a little bit about it prior to Mirrorism, and that's why I was able to perform well on the memory competition and things that I did. But when I realized that the healthcare side of everything wasn't really going to equip me with what I needed or what I wanted in order to progress as I desired, I realized the most effective way that I can handle the progression I really want is to pursue it head on and to find my own helps and aids, accomplish what I desire. The interesting thing, though, for me, I was going to a public school later because I had to graduate since my mom hadn't accounted for all the credits, but I was homeschooled. It was what I found out was public schooling was a whole lot easier than homeschooling, because homeschooling I had to learn kind of my and find the resources that would help me to grasp everything that I did. But I got recognized at the public school for helping another student because I found an accommodation that I wanted. And I almost thought I was going to get in trouble for using it because it was just a speech to text-to-speech add-on for Chrome, on Google Chrome, if you're familiar with that browser. I added it to my PC so I could use it when we were going over different documents. They're supposed to provide audible accommodations for every book at public schools. And the teacher had not been able to find an audiobook for this PDF that he found. However, because I was using the speech-to-text attachment I got on my Chrome account, I was able to help another student find that. I got recognized for that, like I said. But what I found is the most effective way for me to handle any of the problems that I face was to really research it myself and figure out what can I do to aid myself when I may not have what I need. If there's, it's kind of, you know, the whole when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. Well, if life gives you an orange, you don't just have to make orange juice. There are many different things you can do. The citrus and the peel, if you use it in the right way, you can actually turn into an insect repellent. So you can have orange juice and not have to worry about mosquitoes when you're sitting outside drinking your orange juice. It's a matter of using each of the different things that you have in your life for any actual use that they have. Because there's a whole lot more we can do on this earth than we even realize, but we hold ourselves back sometimes because we think we have to fit in the cookie cutter.
Absolutely. How'd you get so wise?
Well, truthfully, the best I can equivalent it to is a book that I read when I was 12 years old. It's composed of actually 66 different books, over 40 different authors. It was written over almost 2,000 year period of time, and it was also written in different languages. Now, I read the English translation because that's what I can understand best. But reading that book gave me a vast amount of knowledge, helped me understand a whole lot about the world that I'm currently living in, and it kind of gave me an upper hand.
Can you tell?
The book? You want to know what the book is?
What it was?
Yeah,
I do.
It's a lot of people actually have it, but they don't realize it. It's the Bible.
Okay, you caught me.
yeah.
a lot of people don't know everything about it, and I don't know everything about it. I'm not going to say I do, but I learned that it is full of wisdom. I don't know if you're familiar with the book of Proverbs. It was written by Solomon. He was a king and bought all times, and he was noted as the wisest man on earth. But it's amazing the depths of knowledge within Scripture and in the Bible. Neat thing is in 2 Timothy 3:16, it says that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God. And if you study the Greek word inspiration, it actually means God breathed. So it means that God actually wrote Scripture essentially himself by speaking it or putting it in the hearts of those who penned each word so that we could have it today.
Awesome. And that was a lot of years later when that came up. And I have to think that there's some, I've heard before some, I don't know, the selection committee, whatever you want to call it, that chose the books that comprise the Bible today, that there were other books that were left out. Now,
that is
a couple ways.
True. Sorry, I've done a little bit of study about this, if you don't mind me saying anything right now.
No, I do. I'd like to hear what you have to say. I only assume on that it came out the way it was supposed to, taking it on faith. But
I
you tell me.
So. So
that's where I left it. I have no one to ask, right? Why did you
Bible
pick those?
That I know.
So I just...
The Bible that I know, I studied the 66 books we consider canon. I typically reference the King James Version. The only reason I reference that version is because it was a word-for-word translation from the Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic, that the original texts of Scripture were. Now, I don't rely on it to get everything from Scripture, because if I really want to get everything I can from Scripture, I reference a concordance to figure out the exact Greek or Hebrew word. If you can't tell, I do a lot of study. I guess I'm a little bit of a word nerd anyway. I go deep to figure out the truths about everything that I do study, especially when I'm a little bit confused about something. But what I've found is the tongue, the Bible actually says that in the words of the death and life, that was one of the things. Now, I'm paraphrasing, so that's not the exact way I think it's said. But
I get it.
Our words have the ability. We can speak life or we can speak death. That's, I mean, you've probably seen it all around us. People, especially in society the past couple of years, much with cancel culture and all that stuff, but like, I mean,
absolutely.
That's even caused suicides and things. So it's literally in the power of the tongue. So I can, it's right there. But also I've had kids that I've talked to, and I didn't know this, but in high school, I said a word of encouragement just because I passed them. That's what I sought to do. And then a couple days later or weeks, months, years, depending on how they want to actually handle it, they said, thank you for what you said to me, because I was going to end it that day. And I had no idea how much it really affected them. But I sought to say a kind word, because the way I understand it, truthfully, it doesn't make sense that the Bible could even exist without divine intervention. Because of the way it truly is and the way it lines up, and the other crazy thing is the Bible has a lot of prophecies about even today. And a lot of those are showing themselves with the different things that have been happening. It's kind of creepy. But believing
truly
that the Bible is true, I sought to actually learn everything I could. That's not actually the gist of how I became confident in what the Bible is, what all the Bible holds and how it's true. When I was 12 years old, I had to figure out what I believed for sure, because I grew up in a Christian home, I think like most of us do, but I grew up in a Christian home and I wasn't content to believe that. So I started researching other things to figure out what I believed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I think that's a common thought. So did you wind up coming all the way back around? Yes?
So basically what I did is I got on the internet wherever I could, and I researched, like I said, any religion I could possibly find. I researched Hinduism, Islamic beliefs, Buddhism, Catholicism, tribal beliefs, you name it. I did my best to find it, and I sought to look into every single detail. And I decided that each of the perspectives that somebody had, there's a purpose. There's a reason that they had these perspectives. So there's got to be a root truth in each of them. So
yeah.
I decided is I needed to find the one good thing in each of them and figure out where they all point, because that's the only thing that made sense to me. So that's what I sought to do.
Mm-hmm.
In Islamic beliefs, now there are a lot of different things where they do not. If I don't know if you're familiar with Allah, the God of Islam, and all that, but Islamic beliefs actually have a portion where they do talk about killing the infidel and various things. So it's very crazy. But if you really want to see anything from Islamic beliefs that points you to a truth, it's that God must be holy. Unfortunately, Allah is not holy, but God must be holy, because if he's not holy, there's no reason we should serve him. So from Islamic mm-hmm. beliefs, I got God must be holy. From Buddhism, I recognized that we should respect everything that God has given us in our body. We should take care of our body. Buddhism has a lot of great health practices. Even meditation is practiced within
yeah.
Buddhism to an extent. So I learned
yeah.
that Buddhism teaches stewardship of the body. And then Hinduism hits on the stewardship essentially of everything else around us. Now, they believe there's a specific God for just about everything. Not quite, but if you really look into Hinduism, you see that. But we should respect and take care of each of the things that we are given. So Hinduism, Islamic beliefs, Catholicism is kind of a branch of Christianity, and it kind of varies, because it's not correct theology if you really follow it all the way. They kind of mix works in with grace, if you're familiar with that concept. But basically from Catholicism, we should seek to respect everything, kind of like Hinduism and Buddhism, but we should use everything that we have to glorify the Lord. If you look at Catholicism and you see a lot of the different practices that they have, they were a big part in Christmas, the Christmas that we know today in Western culture. But if you look at mm-hmm. the way that they handle things in Catholicism, they say a lot of different prayers. The only thing that I really have a problem with regarding Catholicism is they almost turned it into a ritualistic religion. But I believe it's a relationship that makes the difference, because I believe we're meant to have a relationship with the Lord, and it's our relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ that can make us right in the eyes of God.
Yeah, my only problem with that particular faith is that, and it's interesting, I did something similar to you, but it was many moons ago back in college. I took comparative religion. And so mm-hmm. you're spot on about everything that you said. Where I got to in my life beyond comparative religion is that I can dial direct to God and
yes.
go to the book myself. I don't need to call anybody father who's not my dad except God.
Yes.
That
was the other thing.
So I don't need to hear it filtered through someone else. So no disrespect for however God comes to you, and whatever works for you listeners, is your deal. For me, I'll tell another story another time, but anyway, that's the problem I've got with that, is just that, and I also saw from acquaintances some hypocrisy. You know, it's good to confess to someone, you know, when you, to someone, you know, but if you don't change your behavior afterward and you think that saying 12 rote prayers is going to expunge you from repeating bad behavior, you know, that's a game. That's hypocrisy.
You know, the
you know, part of
for,
confessing
for
reproof, it is
right?
to change.
You know the answer for reproof, to actually fix those behaviors, right? Because 2 Timothy 3.16 says that all scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for instruction in righteousness. So if you really want to conduct yourself in a way that is honoring, not even just honoring to God, but in a way that's decent, really, as a human, that what a lot of people don't realize in our Western culture is we seek to have good morals. We seek to support morals in our culture, but we don't always remember where we got our morals. And that was primarily from Scripture. But since all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine and instruction in righteousness, that's where we should find our morals. So that's my personal belief. And I know some people may vary from that. But so far, basing that understanding of morals on Scripture, I have not gone wrong. I haven't had an issue where this, if I seek to follow what Scripture says, that somebody is wronged in the midst of it. Some people might get offended at my boldness and my belief of who the Christ is, but that's not a moral issue. That's an issue of the heart and what someone individually believes. I've been able to respect others, and the other interesting thing is Islamic beliefs differ greatly from Christianity, and they actually shortly after Christianity became a thing. If you're familiar with the origins of Islamic beliefs, they kind of went off, and I think it was Abraham had Jacob, or Abraham had, I'm trying to think, Isaac and Ishmael. And if you follow a lot of it, so it's very interesting the way that they go. But I've had conversations with those who practice Islamic beliefs, and there's been no enmity between us. There's been no problem. We can have civil conversations. And that's, I think, partially because I wasn't seeking to shove my beliefs on anyone. I don't want to shove my beliefs at all anyway, because that doesn't make sense to me. I just want people to know the truth and allow them to make their own decisions, because the Bible says that you shall know the truth and the truth shall make you free.
Right. But that's funny. I just said that to someone this morning. yeah, she was talking about writing out an inventory, if you will, a personal inventory. And because it seemed so overwhelming, you know, it gets to the point where in that circumstance, you know, in any circumstance, really, even recovery here, you know, something can seem so big and overwhelming that part of our brain will say, oh, I'm not good enough. This is too big. I'll never finish it.
No kidding.
And all of the answers that take you to screw it and you don't do it. And I was telling her that if she took bite-sized pieces and didn't look at the whole, but looked at what was right in front of her and took bite-sized pieces a little at a time and just tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, the truth will set you free and the rest of it will come.
Yep.
You know, don't worry about judging it, critiquing it, second-guessing it. Just start. And it won't overwhelm you to not look at the whole. You know, each more will be revealed. Each thing will unfold, but you have to start first.
Yep.
And so that's funny that I would hear that tonight too, and I was just talking about that earlier. I always think that coincidences are God's way of working anonymously is what I say.
Another thing I'm thankful for is the Lord's leading amidst everything. Because just before my aneurysm, I was very close with my girlfriend at the time, and I had a habit. Every morning I would wake up, and we had a texting policy, but we could only text after 8 a.m. and until 10 p.m. We weren't allowed to text outside of that. So, and I thought to respect her father, but I would text her every morning at 8 a.m. I would say, "Good morning, beautiful. I hope you're having a great day at school. I'm praying for you, and I love you." Okay? Just before my aneurysm ruptured. Now, for all the hopeless romantics out there, this might sound really cool for you. I know it was, I'm one of the hopeless romantics, so I thought it was cool. But just before the aneurysm, she gave me her phone, okay? And I went in, and I didn't know why, but I felt God impress my heart to put a reminder in there to go off every morning that said, "I love you." So I did. I thought it was so stupid because I wake up every single morning, 8 a.m., to text her, "Good morning, beautiful, and I love you." Like, those were the two things that I made sure no matter what. And I thought it was so stupid. But God impressed my heart to put this reminder in her phone. And she took a screenshot when it happened in the morning because I was in a coma for 10 days. So I was in a coma. I wasn't able to tell her verbally, but she knew. And I thought that was really cool to see the way God leads. And yes, diehard hopeless romantic out there like me, isn't that awesome?
No, that is beautiful. And I'm sure she thought so too. And that's also interesting. I was in a coma 11 days. And had a rupture. So, interesting. We parallel some on that. But
I am curious. Do you remember hearing anybody talking while you were in the coma?
People outside, you mean?
Yeah.
I had a near-death experience when I was in the coma, but I don't remember hearing people talk that were present in the earthly plane.
Because when I was in my coma, I looked into it later because I could actually hear some of the things some people were saying. Also, it was kind of sad. So more of the diehard hopeless romantic story. It was kind of sad because I heard she would cry. My girlfriend, she would sit next to me and cry. She would tell me how hard things were. And how she just wishes she could talk to me because I used to be the strong one that would help her out, give her some guidance. And she just felt so alone in that time. And it was so hard for me in the coma, because I couldn't get out of the bed. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't tell my body what to do. But coolest thing that I love to this day, my first distinguishable words out of the coma were really breathy, "I love you." And
aww.
I don't know if you can understand that, but it was, "I love you."
Yeah.
And I said it over and over again, trying to make sure she could hear me, because it took all the strength I had. My brain was still trying to remember how my muscles worked so I could speak. But it was a really breathy,
"I love you."
And she got really excited. And I hear my sisters tell me the story sometimes, but she got really excited and she just said, "I love you," like 10 times. And it was just cool.
Awesome. So did you have any experience in your coma where you had a near-death experience?
So they expected me not to be able to make it when when they were rushing me from one hospital to the other, when they were taking me to Children's, so that I could get the brain specialists there.
Right.
I did have near-death experience. I did, however, feel the peace of God take me over at that time. I was contemplating in the coma. I thought, Lord, is this the end? He said, well, it's not the end yet, obviously, because you can still think enough to hear me and talk to me. But it's going to be a long road. So don't be afraid. It's going to hurt. It's going to be difficult. But I'll be with you through it all. And I can tell you to this day, he has never left me or forsaken me.
Awesome. It's interesting how those different messages manifest. What I experienced, I felt a takeover, that's for sure. But I went on a journey, and it was actually my grandfather who gave me a message from God. Wasn't time, and I came back. But that experience that I had let me know if I doubted it, and I really didn't doubt it. But it let me know a couple things for sure, and that's that there was a God and that there is that our spiritual being continues to live. I don't know, you know, in my experience, a lot of people will say, well, do you want to know what happened? Maybe you can give me some insight.
Were you asking if I wanted to know what happened with, well, I don't know.
The near-death experience?
The concept. Are you talking about yours? Because I would love to hear yours if you wanted to share that right now.
That's what I was wondering if you wanted to know, because you might have some insight.
Yeah.
So I'm in a coma, and I'm not aware of anything, and I'm on a respirator, and they don't think I'm going to make it. And I remember my first recollection is, like, say you were laying down and somebody put a swath of cloth over your eyes, so when you opened your eyes, all you could see is that color. First became aware of seeing the color green. And I remember being not at all scared, completely calm and peaceful, but I was inquisitive because the color green started backing up. And as it's backing up, I'm more curious about it because the color was so intense. And
would you almost say vibrant?
Yes, it was vibrant.
Okay.
It was almost alive. It was so
intense. I remember something like
and
that,
vibrant.
Too.
Well, so it goes back a little bit further, and I'm seeing the sprig of, like, a pine tree. And it's almost like I'm part of the tree because and this whole time I'm just feeling curious, not fear, not thinking anything, just observing. And I can see the little nubby things and the pine needles and I'm in awe of this tree, and then suddenly I'm standing next to it and I'm looking out over this big field, blue sky, and all these people are out there yonder, and they were in different period of dress. And then a little girl with long hair and ribbons in her hair probably from the Pioneer era, I guess, whenever they were using like a hula hoop, but rolling it in front of them and guiding it with a stick. I saw this little girl go through my field of vision and look over and smile and laugh. And I felt my heart happy, you know, seeing her and her pure joy, you know, as she was playing. And then she was out of the field of vision. And I'm looking back out at those people and my, excuse me, my eyes focus on a man who's got his back to me, and my eyes are starting looking at the back of his shoes, like on the ground. And as my eyes start scanning up his body, he's starting to turn around. And when my eyes got to his face, he had turned around and our eyes met, and it was my grandfather who had died and I had been very close to. And I wanted to go there. I wanted to go there. I took a step to go hug him, be with him, whatever. And he telepathically, if you will, said, "It's not your time." And it was, when I took that step, it was as if I had hit plexiglass and boom, I was back in my body. And though I didn't hear voices when I was in a coma, I do remember feeling that pain in my head. It never quit from the time it started. And one of the things you said about them calling it a thunderclap headache and you reframing that to, like, yeah, it's not like any headache I've ever had. It's like being shot in the head. That's how that pain was, and it never quit. It didn't quit when I was in a coma. So whatever drugs they were giving me, I wasn't able to tell anyone, but I could still feel that pain. But except for that departure, when I willingly went, and if it would have been up to me, I would have stayed. But what it proved to me was that life doesn't end. I mean, it might end, it does end in the human existence, but our soul moves on.
It's eternal.
Now, it's eternal, exactly. And that proved it to me. Now, some people will call that, you know, that they went to heaven or whatever. I call it, I would liken it more to the pearly gates, because I don't believe that the spiritual realm looks like the human realm, okay? For whatever reason, maybe God makes it familiar to us as we're transitioning. And perhaps had I passed over, been able to go through and go lock hands with my grandfather, perhaps he would have walked me to the next realm, to the spiritual realm, and things would have been completely different and nothing we can even imagine. But that familiarity, I think, perhaps helps or is part of the transition. So I never say I went to heaven and came back. I've read some near-death experience stories, and they can believe what they want to believe. To me, I think if I would have made it to heaven, I would still be there. I think that I had a brush with the pearly gates enough to see and to prove to me that life is in fact eternal, and that I will see familiars, is what I call them. The Bible might call them something else. But that I'll see familiars and other souls that I've been bound to in the human existence. Not all of them probably, but some that were very material and contributed something big, you know, some big lesson here, that I will see those people again. And that gave me a lot of comfort. And I didn't, you know, I didn't have, I was a hopeless romantic, but the person I was dating at the time, I was putting through medical school. And when my experience came back to me, it wasn't the minute I woke up, okay? When I woke up, I was like, where am I and what the heck happened, you know? I was processing in the moment, you know? It was not for, and I don't know, maybe a couple months, and it was what set it off, the recollection coming back together in my mind whenever it was a while later, was I was in the car being driven somewhere, and it was a sunny day, and there was snow on the ground, and the sun hit a glass sign and caused a prism that shined green across the snow, and it clicked, and then the recollection came back to me of exactly what happened as I was staring at the snow, and that's how I remembered it. But when I told it, and it was funny, the one similarity about your girlfriend, when my mom was in the room with me, and when they took the respirator off, I didn't come back for about 3 days. But while the respirator was out, with that same throaty whisper, I said, the colors are so bright. The colors are so bright. And so my mom heard me say that twice, so she knew she wasn't hearing things. And then I went quiet, and it took a couple days before I woke up, and then we were all dealing with what we were dealing with in the moment, and seeing that I could talk, was going to need some trouble walking, that kind of thing. But when I told my memory of the near-death experience, my mom believed me. Maybe mothers would just do this, but she also heard me say something that I wasn't aware of when I was saying it, you know what I mean? But she believed me, everything that I said, and my husband then, and I have to suggest that you don't get married right after a brain aneurysm. That wasn't a good time for me to make a big life decision before I had filtered what I had just gone through. I couldn't take away what I had just gone through, the horror of what I had just gone through, by making a happy wedding, you know. Yay, let's throw out that horror of brain surgery and bring in a pretty wedding, you know. Yeah, you know, put a cherry on the top and call it a day. It didn't work, you know, but my husband did not believe me, and he thought it was the drugs, you know, from that they were using to put me out when I was having the surgery. And I assured him that I didn't need to be in medical school to know, you know, what's real is the sun comes up in the morning. You know, what's real is that one day comes after another, that what I experienced was as real as any reality in my life. It wasn't a thought, a guess, a hopeful wish. It was real. You know, what happened was real. I couldn't explain or interpret all of it any more than I have to you already. But I knew that it was real, and he insisted and could never come to the place where he finally, you know, I mean, I'm not a liar. He believed I believed it. You know, he believed I was naive, that it was something about the medication, and that was bound to not work out because I was going to be going through some pretty profound change, and we weren't going to be on the same page. Now, back in retrospect, and it doesn't really matter because it's over. You know, retrospect is over. And that didn't work out. That didn't work out. I kept paying until he was done with medical school. In fact, I found him his first job, hooked him up with his first job, and then I left and got a divorce. I needed to do what I didn't do before, and that's process Kim before I could process being part of a couple, especially somebody that didn't have the same belief system. And not that you have to think identically. A decade later, I did get married, and it's my husband that I've been with now. He didn't know me before, obviously, to have anything to compare me to, a before and after, like my first husband did. He just thought I turned kind of spacey, flaky, still thought I was fun and nice and enough to ask me to marry him. My aneurysm happened on January 9th, and they misdiagnosed it and sent me home. And you want to talk about grace and miracles. In fact, I wrote a book about it. You should check out my website, inaflash.org. How quickly your life can change, right? In a flash.
I've thought about writing a book about mine. But yeah.
You should. Well, and you
will
at some point.
I've actually got a couple of books to write. Yeah, it's going to take a while.
And it's okay. My thing happened in 1995, and it wasn't until the end of 2011 when I had a major shift in my life that I had to leave my career, and it opened the time for me to be able to sit down and do that, you know, to write that book. And that's ultimately what brought me here. But when they misdiagnosed me and sent me home, a couple miracles were there. First of all, I lived alone in my own home. And if I would have been with a friend or taken a cab or whatever, I would have gone home and been dead, and that would have been the end of the story. Boom. But that day, and this was very odd because it just didn't happen hardly ever, is that I was in sales and I had made a huge sale that was going to really increase my monthly income substantially. I was working on it in November and December, I made the sale, found out that I did in December, got them all set up to start January 1. And then January 9, I have this aneurysm. Now, the client could have left, but they didn't. They were very good about it. In fact, they said I was in their thoughts and prayers, get better. I had earned the business and not to worry about it. But anyway, that day I was looking for a way out of the office early because I had made the sale. It was around the holidays and I was trying to skip school, if you will. And so I was trying to sneak out, and my dad got a hold of me and asked me, I was going to deliver a paper that really I could have put in the mail, but I told my assistant I needed to go deliver this paper down to my new client, and I was taken off and I wouldn't be back today. And my dad winds up catching me and asked me what was going on. I told him, and he said, how about if I drive you down there if you're just dropping off a paper, and then we'll go to this cappuccino shop that was a couple blocks away from there, down in this old markety artsy area of town where this business was located right outside. So I said okay, and because of that, my dad was driving. Otherwise, 99.9% of the time, I would have been driving myself. But he's driving. I drop off the paper. I do what I need to do. I get back in the car. We start driving that two blocks, and that's when the pain shot through my head like glass. And I yelped, and I drew in my hands and my arms, and if I would have been driving, I wouldn't have been in control of the car. Because you know how intense that feeling is.
Oh, yeah, it is.
You know, I
you
recoiled.
You can't really describe it,
you know,
adequately.
Right. So my hands, you did it. To another survivor, I think you can. Mm-hmm. You did a good job. But that's how I felt. I mean, I just recoiled everything and yelped. And my dad said, "What's wrong?" And I said, and I was 35 at the time, and I was at the top of my health, the top of my game, the top of my finances, the top of my looks. Everything was going great for me right then. I'd always been really healthy, and we don't have any in our family tree that anyone is aware of. And I said, I need to go to a hospital, which is pretty serious coming out of me, right, for my dad to know that. And interestingly, that year, again, we're in January 9th of 1995. For Christmas, my dad had gotten his first cell phone, the kind that were the size of a shoebox. And he had our doctor's number in it. And he called it. He just immediately responded. He knew I wouldn't say I needed to go to the hospital and have this reaction I was having, which was not a discussion, you know. It was trying to what you were doing. And so called, and our doctor met us at the emergency room, and he said I was having a muscle spasm in my neck. And I knew that wasn't true. And he wrote out a prescription for pain medication and sent us off on our way. And I remember standing in the drugstore with the room spinning while my dad was getting the medicine. And I just couldn't talk. I was still comprehending at that point, but I couldn't talk. I was still trying to get a grip on staying upright and figuring out what the hell, you know, was happening to me.
That
because
sounds so
and,
much. That sounds so much like it was when I went to an urgent care just about a week prior to the rupture, because I had been having the headaches for a good while, and they didn't do a CAT scan or an MRI. That was one thing I was not happy about. But they prescribed pain meds. I don't really take pain meds unless I have to. I'll take ibuprofen when I need to prevent any further damage so that my muscles can heal properly, but I don't like to take pain meds. And I was frustrated as well, but I don't want to stop you in your story. Keep going.
Well, all I was going to say is the only reason I relented and left and was going to take a pain pill is I thought if the pain pill would make the pain stop long enough for me to be able to articulate he was wrong, you know. Keep looking. Mm-hmm. It's something else. It ain't a muscle spasm in my neck. But I didn't have the wherewithal to be able to do that. And so, anyway, again, miracle, my dad says, tell you what, why don't you come to our house until the pain medicine kicks in and we can make sure you're okay, and then I'll take you home. I don't want to just drop you off the way you're feeling and leave you alone. And so I went to their house, and very shortly after that, I did start the vomiting, violent vomiting, which really hurts your hurting head even worse. And
yes,
they called this this doctor, and like it was probably later afternoon when this was happening, so in the evening, they called the doctor and told him what was going on. And the guy struck out the second time. He said, the pain pill is probably too strong for her. Just give her half of one next time. And I spent that whole night vomiting and in that pain. And in the morning, by the time morning came, when I went to speak, I would stutter about every fifth or sixth word. And my mom was watching me, and she would say the word, you know, I was trying to say. And we played that for a few sentences, and I could comprehend her. I couldn't spit out what I had to say.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, her lips were moving, and I couldn't understand her anymore. And at that point, she said something naughty about the doctor, and they took me to the hospital where they did a CAT scan, and the bleeding aneurysm was right there. And then I don't remember anything. I don't remember. The last thing I remember is standing in the kitchen with my mom talking to me and having her fill in the blank for me, and then her lips moving and me not able to comprehend her. And that's all I remember. I did go to the car on my feet and walk into the hospital, but I don't remember that. I don't remember anything until 11 days later. But anyway, I couldn't talk or comprehend by the time I got there.
I just remembered walking out to my sister.
And I remember telling her that I felt like I got shot in the head. And then I remember, like you said, like anything anybody said just seemed like it was gibberish. Like I couldn't understand at all what it was that they were saying. It was like as though they were talking in a foreign language or something, because I guess my brain just couldn't process it.
Yeah, I could, in retrospect, I see the deterioration where it was going, you know, from the point of feeling that pain to it never going away, even when I was in a coma. Somewhere in there, I had the brain surgery, and I was blessed that this was another miracle. Micro-narrow surgical techniques were pretty new. Normally, you just died when that happened. It wasn't even a matter of making it to the hospital fast enough. They didn't really have anything to do about it. And so a Swiss doctor, Yasser Jill, I think his name was, came up with the beginnings of micro-neurosurgical techniques. Well, when they figured out the techniques, they needed to have tiny tools to work in the tiny area with the microscope. And so this guy even made a couple of the tools. Well, we didn't have anybody in our city who would have been able to fix me, to do a craniotomy, but we had a visiting neurosurgeon who had studied with Dr. Yasser Jill for years, who was in our city teaching our doctors how to do this procedure. And when he heard about me, you know, that was his dream come true, right? Because here's the perfect candidate,
perfect timing,
to
right?
be able to fill the surgical suite. Yes, it was great for him, you know. He got to actually have a live body, you know, that was going through it right then, that, you know, the city, the surgical suite was, or theater, surgical theater was full of surgeons from all over the city watching my surgery happen. And so I couldn't have done any better at that time with that surgeon, but for that surgeon being there. And then, you know, he was there over the next year, and so I had my few follow-up visits with him, mm-hmm. just basically, you know, that he planted a mean clip, you know, he saved my life. But then, you know, that's what surgeons do, surgery, and then you're done with them, you know. That's not going to be the person that you go back to talk about those residuals we were talking about or life on the other side of the brain injury. You know, it's not going to be that doctor. Well, anyway, then he moved and left Nebraska and went to wherever the next state he was going to be was. But I was so fortunate to have had him in town and, you know, that he was my surgeon. And back then, the original clips were made of a different kind of metal that is not compatible with magnetic fields. And so he told me that I'd never be able to have an MRI. And so I have on a card that I can never have an MRI because it will dislodge or possibly yank that clip out of my head. And, you know, I had a doctor tell me once that he thought that the MRI machines had changed to accommodate. I know that a couple years after my surgery, they quit making clips in that material and made them in titanium or something that is compatible with magnetic fields. But okay, so they changed, but I'm an antique clip, you know. So, you know, that was a pretty young age, 35, to never be able to have an MRI again in my life. So some of my future may be about some guesswork, not being able to have that particular diagnostic test. It even makes me a little nervous with all the 5G fields going up all over
place. But there is a positive. There is a positive with that. Because if you're an antique, you just increase in value every single day of your life, right?
Thank you. That feels good when you're an antique, to hear that from time to time. Yeah. That's interesting. Well, I really appreciate you coming on tonight, and it's been so good to meet you and be able to talk to you and hear about your experience and have you share it with the audience. And I appreciate one of the things, you know, while we've talked, but on the show, you know, I've had people talk about a lot of different things and I've made reference to, but, you know, answers being in a book that probably almost all of us have somewhere, like you said, don't know we have it or do know we have it, but it's been in the bookshelf for a long time. You know, there's a lot of comfort there. I've read the Bible twice, and even I didn't know that you were going to say that because it's been a while. I'm not a spring chicken. And the two times I read it was back, the first time was somewhere after I was taking comparative religion. I was reading it.
Yeah.
And then the next time was maybe, I don't know, maybe a decade or so later. It was probably not long after, you know, the aneurysm and that marriage not working out, because talk about hopeless romantic. I always wanted to, I was raised in a generation where you grow up and get married and have a family, but, you know, there were also women doing things other than being a teacher or a nurse. Yeah. And so I was a financial consultant and I was successful and I lived on my own and I thought I had all the time in the world. And then five, you know, my life almost ends. And so it wasn't my idea, but when he had been my boyfriend for about a year and a half, I have the aneurysm in January. He asked me to marry him in April, and we get married in October. And, you know, part of the impetus was not only to not have to process the horror I went through, but last call to try to have a family. And the doctors had told me not to absolutely not try to do that after what I had just been through. But I was willing to try it, and it didn't happen. He didn't want to, and I wasn't completely honest. I don't know that I was dishonest. He didn't want to, and I didn't say that I wasn't doing anything to prevent it. And it just wasn't meant to be, I guess. And so, you know, that didn't happen. And so I knew when I left and got that divorce that it was not only that relationship at that time that was going away, but an ideal, a dream, you know, that I, an expectation that I had had ever since I was a kid, you know, that if I left that, I wasn't planning on being a single mom, let's put it that way. You know, I knew some people who tried that, and it seemed pretty difficult, and I think kids could use two parents, and even then it's not easy, you know. But
oh, certainly not.
Anyway. But anyway, that being that, I think, you know, things, like I said, I have to have faith there was other purpose, and there has been. You know, a lot of things have presented themselves to me over the years, but you have to be open to it. And things that you never thought would be a reality, or I would never think that, I would never try that, I would never do that. You know, you can never say never and have to remain open-minded. And the way I put it is, you know, the brain injury set me on a path. And along this winding path are what I call lantern holders. And just about, you know, when I'm going up the path and ready to turn around and run back to the beginning, I see somebody holding the lantern illuminating the path up ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be somebody who... God's messenger. It's going to be somebody that's got the piece of what I need to keep going.
One thing I'm thankful
for
is that I've learned in life, every path has a purpose.
Yes. And we don't have to know what it is. We have to have faith that every path has a purpose, but it's not always our business to know what that purpose is right now. And that was something that was hard for me to come to grips with, you know, is I want to know now, you know, what the answer is. And, you know, I've learned along the way that I just need to have faith that there is an answer, that I will be provided for, you know, those things will be provided to me as I need to know them, and not in my time all the time, but in God's time. Sometimes our time aligns, and other times I have to trust. And that's gotten easier over the years when I've seen that it works. And try explaining that to somebody who's never done it yet or tried it yet but doesn't have that trust or that faith.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you can give them 20 examples just off the top of your head, you know, of times where it worked out like that and you're sincere in your belief like you are, you know, and like I am, I, you know, somebody may not agree with us, but I think that if they feel like I do anyway about you, I believe that you're honest and credible and very thoughtful about what you believe and how you think and the kind of faith that you have. And anybody who's out there new going through the after effects of brain injury, or somebody who's been around a long time, you know, we're going into, I talked about Halloween earlier, you know, we are going into a time for a lot of us, I think in a week or so, it's going to be getting dark at 4 o'clock instead of 9 o'clock, and it's going to be getting really cold out. And I know I have some trouble with seasonal affective disorder at times, although God sent a messenger, I'll have to tell you really briefly about. But anyway, because there's not, you know, in that brittle cold, there's not, like I maybe because I was born in spring, I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but, you know, I love the life and the color of new growth, new baby robins, you know, new whatever, you know, that you've got at that time of year. And in the winter, that cold, different pain conditions I have, you know, are worse the older I get, the colder it gets, and it's harder to drive around, and there's no green, you know, unless it's inside. So winter, it isn't my favorite time, but I can't leave here yet. But it was interesting because 4 years ago, in October, I looked up, and this is the other book I wrote. You'll see it on that website too. Not being a shameless self-promoter or anything, but they're short. I just wrote down thoughts on a couple things, but only because I thought it was miraculous. But I looked up, and in my backyard tree, I looked up and I saw this little bitty owl. And he was up about 15 feet. When I was looking up words, you talked about being a wordsmith. I kept calling it the hole and the knot and different names. And when I decided to write the book, see, I named him because Hootie stayed. I named him Hootie Owl. So Hootie stayed from October to March the first year. And I do photography, and it was the first winter that I had a jubilant attitude about winter, because every morning when I would open the door in my garage that leads to the backyard, that tree is right outside there, and I'd wake up for my morning coffee and open that door and peek out, and Hootie would be there. And that would put a big smile on my face that Hootie was there. And I'd go out and say, "Good morning, Hootie." And I would talk to Hootie, and I'd rock back and forth, and Hootie would rock back and forth. And so we had this thing, this way of communicating. And I read later, you know, we talked about different faiths in Native American culture. An owl is known to be able to cross the veils between the spiritual plane and the human plane, as I talked about
that
Halloween and the Celts earlier, you know, talking about Halloween, you know, and the veil having a blur. But anyway, Hootie, this is the fourth year that Hootie has come back. And it was when he came back, he goes away, you know, like around St. Patrick's Day. And, of course, the first year I thought I was kind of brokenhearted. I had got used to having him around every day, and I was sad about him going. And some really
different
interesting
migration.
Things happened. Well, they don't migrate, though. But I do have a feeling I might know something. He's an eastern screech that might they don't migrate. But they're the second tiniest owl that they make, which is good because I have three dogs. The tree is in the backyard, and the dogs aren't even aware of Hootie, which is a trip. I'll have to send you a picture or friend me or something because there's photos I took of Hootie on my Facebook page.
Okay.
So if you friend me, you can see Hootie. And anyway, some really trippy things happened that spring and early summer. And so I guess it was the second one. Anyway, the next October, you know, life went on, whatever. I grieved Hootie being gone and whatever and went on with life. The next October, I felt a whoosh of my bangs, and I glanced up because I kind of got in the habit of looking up at the tree, and Hootie was back the next October. So apparently he lives with us for the winter months, October to spring. And then, this is just speculation on my part, but, you know, around that time is when they mate. You know, they find a partner, and usually it's an exclusive partner, but apparently they don't live together all the time. But they have their babies in the spring, and little owls, owlets, topple out of trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so our place wouldn't be the best for little owlets to topple out of a tree with three dogs.
No.
And so
no, it would not.
He's got a preference, and he goes somewhere else, you know, from St. Patrick's Day until October. But I've got to say that it has changed my winters for me to have a source of such joy come and be the messenger of joy, you know, for the winter months, because I can just step outside the door and stand out and take pictures of Hootie. And I think I've got pictures of Hootie doing everything for 4 years. So somewhere in there, like the second year, I think it was, I wrote a book about the experience. And the reason I did it, you won't be able to tell it on this page. At one point, and we got to go, but at one point, Facebook took my page away for an unfair reason that was their fault, and I had to start over. But so many people fell in love with Hootie and the stories that I would tell on Facebook about Hootie that I thought, you know, I should really write a book about Hootie, because looking at how people respond to Hootie, if Hootie had his own page, he'd have more friends than me and most of the people I know. You know, they just love Hootie, you know, seeing what Hootie's doing and hearing me make the comments about it. So I thought, well, I'll write a book and illustrate it, you know, with some of the photographs about Hootie. So I did. And also for my memory, because, you know, we never know as we age how our memory is going to be. But in any case, JJ, it's been great to talk to you and meet you. I hope we can meet again. I look forward to being friends on Facebook. I did want to close tonight only because it's Halloween. You know, the founder of Brain Injury Radio is a musician. They just spent last year doing their final three-album set, and then they were going to go on tour because nobody knew the pandemic was going to last this long. So that didn't wind up happening. And, well, sadly, something else happened. But anyway, Craig is the one who pays for Brain Injury Radio. We've never asked for donations. He just doesn't believe in doing that. But their band is called The THEE, the letter R, Insane. TheRInsane.com. If you go there and you like any of the music, that's one way to help support the network, is by, you know, buying a little of the music and checking it out, because God knows you don't make a lot, $1.60 on a song these days, right? And Amazon,
yeah,
or whoever gets 40% and they get 60% for that. You got to split it with the band and the recording studio. But for Halloween, and I want to wish you all a happy and safe Halloween and life. How weird. You know, we used to only wear masks on Halloween, and now we're going on 2 years.
I never thought I would walk into a bank. I never thought I'd walk into a bank wearing a mask until the pandemic.
I know. Now I'm wondering if you have to wear a mask over your mask. A masked mask. That's something for
y'all
to ponder. But anyway.
Who it is?
That it would. In any case, I'm going to play a song in honor of Halloween from Craig's album. It's called Ghost. Good night and God bless everybody. I will be back next week. I want to thank JJ for joining me tonight, and thank you all for listening and your support. I appreciate it. This is the song Ghost. So if you check out VRinsane.com, this is Ghost for Halloween. And I could relate. How about you?